Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We broadcast from the UC Irvine campus and stream live at kuci.org. This show was recorded on March 18th, 2021. And today my guest is memoirist and historian Russell Shorto. He's author of the best-selling The Island at the Center of the World, Amsterdam, and Revolution Song, and a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. His new book, which is a combination of history and family memoir, is Small Time, A Story of My Family and the Mob, published by Norton. Hi, Russell.
Hi, Barbara. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. I find it really interesting that being a historian, you had no intention of writing about your own past until a relative nudged you into it. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I think it had to do with, well, I know it had to do with the fact that, I mean, I always knew growing up that my grandfather was some sort of mob figure, even though I mean, I knew he was kind of a bad guy, you know. But I also knew that we don't talk about that. And I think there was nothing so formal as a vow of silence or a code of omerta or anything like that. But, I was an obedient son, and I kind of put a wall around that. And I never really went there, but I knew it was a thing because I also never wanted to see a Godfather movie. I never wanted to, I think, participate in the stereotype. You know, that's what I was afraid. Those things were going to try to reinforce this stereotype about who my family was or who my grandfather was.
So when did you know you had a story? When did you know you had enough of a story that it would be a book?
It took a while. As you said, it was my mother's cousin who nudged me. And even, decided, all right, I will go home to my hometown, Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and see if there's material there, because I write nonfiction. If I was going to write this, I wasn't going to make stuff up. And I knew perfectly well that those guys back then who were all dead and gone didn't keep notebooks lying around. So what was I going to base it on? So Frank invited me. He said, if you decided you wanted to get serious about this, come to me and I'll set you straight. And so he invited me to his hangout, Panera Bread. And I thought he and I were just going to have a little chat. It turned out he had put out the word. And in a little while, there were like 8 little old Italian guys gathered around us. And, you know, I had turned on my recorder, and 4 hours later, I turned it off. And I said, all right, this is certainly something kind of exciting. But I still wasn't convinced that it was something I was going to be able to write, because these are just stories, people's memories from 60 years ago or something. So then I went through the next step, which is what I'm more familiar with doing, and that is going to archives, going, getting the police records and the county courthouse. And then I convinced myself, I saw that there was this foundation of documentary evidence that I could marry with these wonderful, I ended up doing more than 200 hours of interviews with people. And so putting those things together is what convinced me that, yes, there's a story here.
Hmm. 200 hours. Did you do any writing in that time, or was it just really a research time, research heavy, and you waited until you got all of that to start writing?
I took some stabs at it here and there, because I'm always sort of trying out what I think the thing is thus far. You know, I'm this far into it. Is this what it is? And then I look at that later and I say, no, that's not it. But at least, you know, it kind of gets me along. It gets me into that space, that kind of space. You know, there's a difference between any kind of, there's a difference, first of all, between the past and history. The past is just that, you know, millions of bits of stuff that happened. And history is a particular path that you weave through those things. And those different attempts were different, you know, attempts at deciding which path or figuring out which of those paths was the right one.
Mm. I'd love to hear you read from Small Time.
Sure. Right. Should I read a couple of pages from the beginning?
That'd be great.
Chapter one is called The Setup. It started one evening when I was home for the holidays. Picture a too warm living room, so crammed with relatives that people's limbs are overlapping. A day or two after Christmas, a cloudy gray night sky, snow starting to fall. I'm a writer of narrative history, by the way, someone who makes a living telling nonfiction stories about the past. So in terms of subject matter, you might think this one would have been obvious to me long ago. It was not. Anyway, the TV is blaring from one corner of my parents' living room. The tree is stuffed into another. A tray of cookies is going around. And somebody mentions that Frankie is in town. Who's Frankie? Your mother's cousin, Frankie Filia. I'd met Frankie once or twice. I knew he was a jazz singer who had left town a lifetime ago for Las Vegas, that he had a long career there, playing gigs and tending bar and casinos. After 5 decades of fingering the thick strings of the stand-up bass, crooning for an endless succession of smoky rooms, he'd decided to retire and come home. An hour later, a couple of carloads of us figure we'll head down to the lounge where Frank now plays once a week in a local geriatric combo. Stepping from the snowy night into a dark room, confronted by the dank smell of all old bars. And there's Frank, luridly lit on the makeshift stage, a little guy in his late 70s, roundish body flanked by the shapely neck of the bass. He puts a hand over his eyes to peer at the doorway, smiles as he sees us, distant relations here to partake of what he's offering. We pile in, order drinks, stand there with our big coats on, ranged around like Easter Island statues. Frank's got a nice, foggy, breezy voice, the kind that invites you to take a ride with him. Volare, fly me to the moon. At a break in the set, there are kisses, greetings. We're standing in a circle, and at some point, Frank looks across at me and wags a finger. Russell, I've been wanting to talk to you. You're a writer. What are we going to do about the story? What story? In the middle of asking, the answer is right there, fully formed in my mind. I feel a need to declare here that I had a normal, small-town American childhood, meaning that it was weird or quaint in all the standard ways. Going on Sunday drives as a family, playing strip poker with hushed friends in somebody's parents' basement, whatever. There was an element of Italian-American self-awareness, but it was mostly limited to food and emotiveness. Long conversations about spaghetti sauce and aunts who kissed you on the lips. Those were the ways we were Italian. Frank shakes his head in exasperation. What story? Your grandfather, the mob. How's that?
That's great. That's great. That was Russell Shorta reading from Small Time, A Story of My Family and the Mob. This chapter is so reminiscent of my big Italian family gatherings when I was a kid. It just drew me right into the story. And I have to say, here and throughout the book, you have a way with a simile and metaphor. I love that image of standing around with big coats on, ranged around like Easter Island statues. That's just great.
Thank you. Since the book came out, I've gotten so many emails from people from different ethnicities, but a lot of Italian Americans who had small town upbringings, there's such an overlap of experience, and that, you know, it's such a nice thing too, for, you know, someone who, my other books are all set in the distant past. So to be writing something that living people can relate to is a new experience, and it's a lot of fun.
I can see that. It is, there is really so much history in this book that I had no idea about. I want to get to some of it in a bit, but it was interesting what you revealed about how the mafia came to be, and even the word mafia. Could you talk about that?
As I said before, I had shied away from the whole subject. So a lot of the when I really dove into researching it, it was a whole lot of it was new to me. It was remarkable to me the extent to which my grandfather's life tracked the rise and then the decline of the Italian American mafia. And I say Italian American because sometimes you think of mob or mafia in terms of various ethnicities. You know, there's Irish gangs and Jewish gangs, but the Italian has everything to do, first of all, with immigration. That period, within a very short span of time, when about 4 million Southern Italians emigrated, they were answering calls from American employers, mostly plantation owners in the South and coal mines, for work that Americans didn't want to do. And so they came here, and then they were brutally discriminated. They were told where to live, where to, you know, where to buy their goods, what to do with themselves. And so that first generation has that experience. And then my grandfather is someone who was a child of immigrants, and he grows up fashioned by that experience. But also, he's going to American schools, and he's taught to admire George Washington and Henry Ford and the titans of American industry and American capitalism, and what these figures like him and the more well-known ones did. What I think was they took that admiration for American capitalism and they applied it in avenues that they could. So I formed kind of a sympathetic a notion of how the mafia formed, because they were restricted. Someone like him, there was no way he was going to be able to go to college. He was not going to grow up to become a bank manager or a manager of a department store or anything like that. And here comes Prohibition. And in Prohibition, suddenly there's this product that everybody wants and nobody can get it. So people like him, his mother was like women, especially single mothers all over the country. By then, his father had died. She ran a still in their living room. And there was a neighborhood, little old Italian man in the neighborhood who was the organizer of these women. And he paid them a percentage. And my grandfather, as a kid on the streets selling Coke bottles of moonshine. So he grows up that way. And then once Prohibition ends, he slides right into the next income stream, which was gambling. And that's what happened all over the country. And that's essentially how it came into being.
Why did Italians immigrate to Louisiana? I think you said New York was first, Pennsylvania was second, and Louisiana was third.
Yeah, Louisiana. Well, it's you know, backing up a step, two historical events that we don't usually associate with one another. The Italian Risorgimento, the coming together finally of all these disparate pieces into the modern nation of Italy. That happens around 1870. And when that happened, there'd always been this tremendous antipathy among Northern Italians for Southern Italians. And when that happened, the Northern Italians had control of the country and they made life even worse for Southern Italians. At the same time, or virtually the same time, the Civil War ends in America. So suddenly, all these formerly enslaved Africans are no longer, they no longer have to work in these jobs that nobody else wanted, such as plantations. And the plantation owners got this idea to advertise on the streets of towns like Messina, which is where my great-grandfather would have heard of this opportunity. And so they went to places like Louisiana and to places like New York State and Pennsylvania, and mostly to places like Johnstown, which were not big cities, but that's where these jobs were. That's where the coal mines were.
Yeah, I kind of got the shivers when you mentioned Altoona, because I grew up in Altoona, and my father apparently was supposed to be a part of the Western Pennsylvania Jewish Mafia, which who knew? And I know nothing about that, but you know, this your book kind of put things together in a way I hadn't thought about before.
There, you know, again, I've gotten so many emails. I've gotten hundreds of emails from people who, for whom the book resonates in different ways. There are people who grew up in small towns, especially in the East Coast, people from Italian American backgrounds, but also Irish American, Jews, and a lot of it has to, you know, they a lot of people have said to me something like what you just said, which is, you know, it gave a framework, or it puts pieces together for me, because there were whispers or just stories in the family about things the older generation or the grandparents' generation did and how they got by. And so that's what I found so fascinating about exploring this story, that it was I had grown up with those kinds of sort of a whispered sense of some operation. Once I decided to do this, it was a chance to try to put those together into a story, into a narrative.
Did you grow up with bigotry? Did you feel bigotry toward Italians in Johnstown?
No, I can't say that I did. That changed, and that's kind of what I chart in the book in a way. My grandfather's generation, he had really no choice. I mean, of course he had other choices, but his choices were very limited. And he grew up in the face of this bigotry. And I talk in the book about, much of the book revolves around his relationship with my father and this central tension between them. They basically didn't speak to each other for a long period of time. And that had to do with the fact that I believe my grandfather felt that his son, his oldest son, my father, didn't have to take that same path. He didn't have to become part of the organization, because by the early 50s, when my father was, you know, starting to stretch his wings, discrimination was a lot less. And so when I came along, you know, I just thought I was, as I read in that opening, I just thought I was an American kid, and yeah, we ate spaghetti every Sunday, you know, that kind of thing.
It was rather shocking and enlightening when I read that, and this is from your book, the 11 men who were hanged in the largest mass lynching in American history in New Orleans in 1891 were not Black but Italian. The New York Times defended the extra legal executions, calling the victims sneaking and cowardly Sicilians, the descendants of bandits and assassins.
Wow. Yeah, you know, I think that really, and you know, as I spent time with the old guys, the old people in town who were reminiscing, they would then, yeah, as you get further into interviews, hours into interviews, they then start to give you the stories they remember from their parents. And then you start to uncover that layer of what people endured way back then, you know, because again, it's not people who are now 80 aren't going to remember that, but their parents did. And that, you know, so that I felt like, and I guess everybody who writes about recent history feels this, like, I'm so glad that I captured these stories from the people while I could, but I'm also, I feel very frustrated that, you know, my grandmother who died in 1987, why didn't I sit down with her and, you know, just turn on a tape recorder and just have her talk? I mean, her life was incredible. But, you know, it's all just fragments now.
You know, it's interesting because my mother's family's from Naples, so northern Italy. My father, his family's from Sicily, and there was a lot of bigotry in our family toward my father because he was from southern Italy. And that is just so odd to me, you know, just within a country, there's something going on. Did you find any of that?
Sure. People who were Sicilian weren't Italian, and they didn't think of themselves that way. And other Italians didn't think of that way themselves of them that way. It was only once they were all kind of crammed together in a ghetto in some town in America that other Americans said, "Oh, you Italians," you know, referred to them collectively. But it was a long while before they kind of identified with one another in that way. Hmm.
You talk about Italian cuisine, which is, it's interesting how we love it now. And I think you said we fetishize it. I believe that was your term. But the people subsisted there in Sicily, mostly on bread and field greens like dandelions.
Yeah, it was a very, very harsh existence. And this is the end of the 19th century. And that was described to me people in the family, but also, that you find accounts of that in books. And I had some sources in the village in Sicily that my great grandparents are from. And so that's what people fled. You know, there were stories of people, of women making bread and like scraping the plaster off the walls into it to kind of make the flour last longer.
Yeah, that's so wild. There's a murder in your book. And was that a big surprise when you started doing it? I mean, did you know about this? You must have heard something about this in the family before you started writing, before you even thought you would write this.
I may have heard about it before then, but as soon as I started talking to, you know, what, as I said, my Panera Bread enlightenment session with all these guys, I mean, one by one, everybody who I would sit down to talk with would pretty quickly say, you know about Pippi, right? Pippi is the name of this bookie who was murdered in February 1960. And and the murder was never solved. And I think that at first I thought, well, you know, I'm writing a mob story, and so a mob story ought to have a murder in it, so I'll spend some time on that. But as I got further into it, and as I got further into my grandfather's story, I came to realize that this story was really central to his, because it happened, my grandfather and his partner, their heyday was from World War II, really the tail end of World War II, to the early 60s. And again, that mirrors the small town mob all over the country when people were, and it was essentially gambling operations. And then in order to maintain them, they had to pay off the authorities, the mayor and the police. And in doing this, they created this kind of bubble around themselves and created this very nice space for themselves and for other gamblers, other people who ran card games and numbers games and things like that.
Hmm. How did you become a historian?
I'm not a trained historian. I just started writing history, and I've been a writer for a long time, and I've written a lot of magazine work, and I've always been drawn to long form magazine pieces. And I did a magazine piece for GQ years ago when Art Cooper was the editor there. I was interested in a group of biblical scholars who in California, who created this certain image of awareness of Jesus, the first, and it was strictly historically based notion of this particular first century Palestinian Jew. And I was interested, I was reading their books, partly because I had been raised Catholic and I had left it. And I think this was, to me, kind of an intellectual way to get back into that. And I had the nerve to ask Art Cooper, the editor of GQ of all places, if I could write about this, these biblical scholars. And he, you know, bless his soul, he let me do it. And he ran the article. And then I just got so into that, that I turned it into a book proposal. And that became my first book. And then my next book was about history. And the next one was, and it was all to me, what I do is narrative history, which is storytelling, true stories set in the past. And it that, and to me means more often than not, two or more people in conflict, because people often tend to get into conflict. And that's how I've made my living ever since. And that was in 1995 that came out. However many years that is, I've kind of honed a way of doing narrative history, which is storytelling, which I think is the truest form of history. And that is what I mean by that is, it's the oldest form. It's how we understand who we are. Your parents tell you stories about your family, that we tell each other stories about our country. And then later you come along, because it's an endless process, and you correct those stories and you change them. It's just an endlessly rewarding career path.
Yeah, in school, I can't remember ever reading any sort of interesting history, you know? I mean, I think history would have been a lot more interesting to have books like yours, or storytelling, like you say, where it's, you know, a writer is telling a story as opposed to, here's a textbook, now learn the history.
Right, with the names and dates and all that.
Right, right.
Yeah, I was never terribly moved by history in high school. And as I think about it, the history classes that I took in college, none of them were in the history department. They were all, I took history of philosophy, I took art history, you know, so I was interested in a historical approach to different subjects, which is what I've done basically ever since then.
So once you do your research, you have, you know, hundreds of hours of interviews, you've gone into archives, what comes next? Do you do an outline and follow it, or what happens next with all that material?
My method is, I guess, a method, but it's sloppy, and I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. As I said before, I'm in there doing some research, and at a certain point I take a stab at writing something. Maybe it's what I think might be the beginning, or the beginning of some section of it. And I'm trying out voices in doing that. And then I'm doing more research, and, you know, this started probably about 8 years ago. So it gestates. And in the meantime, I'm working on other projects. I will then at a certain point start an outline of sorts. And then I start manipulating the outline. And then I might take a piece of the text that I wrote, thinking that might have a place in it, and I might try inserting that somewhere in the outline. And then I start extending a section. I find myself extending a section of the outline. And then I realize that extension of the outline, I'm actually writing a piece of the book. And it might not be the beginning, but I'm writing a piece of it. And so then I'll kind of take that voice and go to the beginning and try it out there. I guess you could say it's an organic method that moves back and forth from the research to outlining to writing.
Say more about trying out voices.
Once you've written for a number of years, you have your voice. And at the same time, every book is different. The relationship between you, the writer, or the narrator on the page, and the reader is different. And it's important to me to find a voice that is suitable to translate this particular material to the reader. When I read the beginning of it, it's a very personal story. So I wanted it, I thought it was appropriate to start, you know, in my parents' living room with all of my family around. And also to start, I just found myself writing in a voice that's much more informal than in my other books, because it just seemed to suit the material and at times in the course of this book, because I'm talking to these old guys and I'm quoting them, and the narrative voice becomes a little bit of a wise guy, you know? So that sort of felt right to me. In other books, I wrote a book about the history of Amsterdam, and the book was going to be history, but I wanted it to have a personal feeling. I wanted you to feel me as an American living in Amsterdam at the time, looking at the city. And so I eventually started the book by starting my day, leaving my apartment and putting my son was a toddler at the time, and putting him on the front of the bicycle on the toddler seat, and then cycling him to the daycare, to the woman that I would drop him off at, and cycling through the neighborhood. So in doing that, I'm giving you a sense of the neighborhood. I'm giving you that feeling of Amsterdam being on a bicycle. And then I'm talking about the neighborhood, how it was developed. And then we get to his the caretaker, and she's a Moroccan woman. And that's, you know, we're then getting into not the Amsterdam of the golden age. This is Amsterdam of now, this very multi-ethnic city. And then after that, I kind of recede. So I, for the most part in the book, I'm telling you the story of the city, but I've already set up myself as a narrator who later, maybe 80 pages later, I'm going to come back and you'll be ready for it. So that's, you know, what I'm trying to do in that case with the voice.
Are you imagining a reader or an audience as you're writing?
Yeah, I think what I do, in any topic that you write about, that I write about, as you do your research, you become a kind of an expert in it. And that is what you need to do. At the same time, there is a danger in that, because once you start to become an expert, you take certain things for granted. So what I have to do is remind myself of the audience. And that audience, I say to myself, that audience is the person I was when I started this. So I, you know, that audience hasn't spent the past 3 years researching this topic. So talk to that person. If I'm talking to myself of 3 years before when I started this, then, you know, I can talk to someone that I imagine, therefore, a reader who is literate, interested in the world, knows a lot of things, but is not completely immersed in this topic. And I need to keep that in mind so that I can have that perspective and keep things in perspective for the reader.
Interesting. You have been listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Russell Shorto. His book is Small Time, A Story of My Family and the Mob, published by Norton. Did this book begin as a book proposal, or did you write the entire book?
No, it was a book proposal. So that was the first, you know, after some years of not committing to it, but doing research and taking a lot of notes. Once I had reached the point of deciding, yeah, there's a lot here, and this is a story that's not just personal, but it's a story that is very rich that people don't know. That is a story of the small town mob in America. Then the next just practical matter is, I had been talking to my agent, who's I've been friends with for years, about this throughout. And at a certain point said, you know, and she agreed with me that, yeah, it's time to start working on a book proposal.
Hmm. Do you have readers for the book as you're going along, or do you wait till you have a draft and give it to your agent and that's it?
Yeah, I do have readers. And you know, I have a sort of core group of readers, but it kind of evolves over time. And then, it's just, you know, by feel, I'll decide, you know, I think at this point, I'd like to have this person to get their reaction. And because I know those readers, that's a good thing. And I can, you know, maybe I can protect myself because a certain person I know won't be too critical, won't be too harsh with me. But, you know, another person, my daughter, Eva, for one, is an amazing reader and an amazing editor. And she will not mince words. So when I'm ready, I give it to her, and she will, you know, she'll be tough in a really good way. You know, she'll do things like memorably. She wrote on an early draft of this book. She wrote across one page, "I am so bored." You need that sometimes.
Yeah, you do. What about the pictures? There's a few photos in the book, and were they a part of the proposal, or did that happen once the book was sold and the publisher said, yeah, a few pictures would be nice?
Yeah, I think it was the latter, except that there were a few quick sketches on cocktail napkins that Frank Filia sketched when we were sitting at Panera Bread, and I was saying something like, he was talking to me about some of these old guys, and I said, you know, I'd just love to know what they look like. And he's an artist, a kind of, you know, good amateur artist. And so he just picked up a pen and sketched them out on a cocktail napkin. So those sketches were part of the proposal, but the rest of it, it was just with my editor deciding that, you know, we didn't need to have like formal, like illustrations throughout or anything like that, but a few just to give you a flavor.
Hmm. Talk a little bit about revision. You have a draft. Do you barrel through the draft, or do you get each chapter as wonderful as it can be, or do you barrel through and then start going through it, or what happens? How does your revision process go?
Yeah, I think I have to get a chapter. I go, you know, I probably do, I don't know, 100 drafts of a chapter or something. And getting it to what I think it ought to be, and having some kind of outline. And different books have pretty extensive outlines, and I look back and the finished book really matches up with the outline. And some books, the outline is really loose and it evolves. But, you know, I've got some kind of outline, some kind of roadmap of where I'm going. And I do pretty much work chapter by chapter. I did an event, the Brooklyn Center for History with Jennifer Egan, the novelist, about 2 weeks ago. And the Brooklyn Center had this idea to put us together because Jenny Egan's last book was Manhattan Beach. It's a historical novel, and it's partly about the mob. And this book is nonfiction and memoir about the mob. And they thought it would be an interesting idea to have us talk about those things and how you deal with history and fact in fiction and in memoir. And it was a great conversation. But what struck me was Jenny said that she writes her first draft blind. So she sat down and started on page one with a writing longhand, and a year and a half later came to the end of the book and only would go back every day to look at the last paragraph she'd written so that she could pick up from there. So I definitely do not work that way.
I so wanted to hear that. And I think I heard about it the day after. I was so depressed.
Yeah, I think somebody told me it's on YouTube, or maybe it's on their website. I forget which.
Oh, I have to check that out. Yeah. She was on the show for that book actually a few years ago. And I remember her talking about the longhand and interesting writing a book that way.
I imagine you have to have such self-confidence to do that.
Hmm. What about writing yourself out of something that's not working? Are you ever, you know, in a mess as you're writing and kind of wondering where to go next, or does the outline keep you on track?
Yeah, I'm constantly in that state of, you know, I'm constantly going back and forth. My wife could speak more eloquently about this than I can, between utter doubt and despair and, you know, this giddiness that, you know, you got something and, you know, this is golden. And then you look at the same thing the next morning and your heart just sinks, you know? So I'm always cycling between those poles.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like what writers go through, right? We're depressed. We're ecstatic. We're depressed. We're ecstatic.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
Any surprises in the writing of the book? Anything that you discovered that just kind of was a major surprise that you didn't expect?
You mean in the story itself?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure. Well, the big surprise for me was I had grown up with the notion that my grandfather, the mobster, had wanted to bring my father, his oldest son, into the business. And that my dad kind of valiantly resisted that. And I had this idea in mind, which was planted there somehow, that he did that for us. You know, he had this young family. My parents were teenagers when they got married. And he was, you know, walling us off from that. And as I talked to more and more of these old guys who had been, you know, part of the outfit back in the day, one of them one day said to me, it wasn't like that. Your dad wanted in the worst way. And I said, what are you talking about? And so I dug around more, talked to other people. And it actually took me a couple of years before I had the nerve to ask my dad if that was true. And, you know, I'm a middle-aged man, but it took me, you know, it's just such a strange thing writing memoir that you get so caught up in it in a way that you're not going to if you're writing about people of centuries ago. And he said, yes, that was the case. And he couldn't say, he didn't even remember telling me or telling us that, you know, the creating this fiction, which he obviously did. So that was a total reversal for me. There were others too. My grandfather, you know, I grew up with him as this very dark figure. I go into the book of how, you know, all these scars that he, all this emotional damage that he caused the family. And yet, you know, this is going back to where we were at the beginning, researching the history of Prohibition and what these people endured and what he and his siblings endured as children, I came to feel some sympathy for him. I mean, I almost couldn't believe I was feeling it, but, you know, I just saw him as this kid who had, you know, very few options in life. So, you know, it's good to be open to surprises when you're writing something, and when it's memoir, then it hits you that much more forcefully.
Did you ever worry about revealing too much? Did you ever have to pull back and kind of soft pedal a situation or a scene because you didn't want to say too much?
I never think that's a good idea at first. I mean, I always want to just go for it as much as I think, you know, what the story deserves. In this case, then later, my family, various family members were involved in my work on this book. And then I gave it to family members in draft. And a couple of them, there were things that they really kind of had a hard time with. And I thought about it and I decided, a couple of these things I don't have to have them in there. You know, I don't have to make people miserable. There were a couple things like that. But my main point there is at first, just go for it. Go all out.
Yeah, because you can edit later. You can take it out. But
yeah, and if you start to pull back while you're writing it, then you're pulling back on the energy too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We are coming to the end of our time. I'm curious what you read for pleasure.
I read all kinds of things for pleasure. I read, I just read Manhattan Beach, which was a wonderful novel. I read fiction. I read history. I read a lot of literary fiction. I'll get into a place where I don't know what to do. You know, I don't know if you get this, like you pick up a book and nothing works for you. Mm-hmm. And when it happens like every few years, I'd say. And when that happens, I pick up the complete works of Sherlock Holmes. And I start in that and I read a couple of those stories. And then it's just kind of, it resets it for me. You know, the old like storytelling, because I think it has something to do with that being a world, like a regulated world, Victorian England, Victorian London. And you know, yeah, there's a lot of craziness in the world, but there's a solution, you know, which is of course fiction, but it something about that resets it for me.
Have you written fiction? Have you a desire to write fiction?
Yeah, I have started and stopped a few times. I have a historical novel that I've been working on and off for a few years, and I'm telling myself that that I have a book that I'm just starting now, a nonfiction book, and I'm telling myself that I'm going to keep this going through that process, and then I'll take, after I finish that nonfiction book, then that novel is coming up.
Interesting. Well, it's been such a great pleasure talking with you about Small Time. I so appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you, Barbara. It's lovely to not just to talk about the book, but to talk about the craft.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. I've been with Russell Shorto. His book is Small Time, A Story of My Family and the Mob, published by Norton. Come back next week. We'll be here again. And have a good week. Stay in the chair, you writers out there.